It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right, Money for Lunch, welcome. I'm glad that you're joining us. You know, Money for Lunch, where the biggest leaders come to feed us. It's kind of weird, right? But anyway, so here we are having lunch with some of the biggest leaders in the world. And today is no exception. Carl Gould is on the show. Carl Gould is a business growth expert. And this guy has done some amazing things, and he's going to be hanging out with us and giving us some bite-sized nuggets that we can apply to our business, our life, and really make both of them better. So I'm looking forward to this conversation so very much, and just tell you a little bit about Carl. Carl Gould is a business growth expert who advises organizations to get to the next level. He is an entrepreneur who built not one, not two, but three multi-million-dollar businesses by the time he was 40. His consulting firm has mentored the launch of over 5,000 businesses in 35 countries, and his team of mentor coaches have conducted over 75,000 sessions with entrepreneurs, executives worldwide. He advises over 100 of the Inc. 500 and, 500 fastest growing companies. Carl Gould, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, Bert, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet, you bet. I'm excited to have you here and just get to know you. So let's talk a little bit about this, because one of the things is you've written several books. One of them you did Blueprint of Success with Stephen R. Covey and Ken Blanchard. Talk about
That's
that
right.
Blueprint of Success real quick.
So I Blueprint for Success was there was a book project that Stephen Covey Sr., the late Stephen Covey, and Ken Blanchard were working on with their publisher. And I, at the time, was writing a book called The Seven Stages of Small Business Success. And it shows companies how to go from startup to seven figures in 3 years or less. And it's a blueprint for fast growth and sustainable growth in a business. And Covey and Blanchard, as I was told, thought it would be a good fit for their book project and asked me if I would be willing to join in and share some of my tips and my observations about what does it take to create a successful business in their book. And so I was absolutely honored and flattered to do so and was happy to do so. And so I got a chance to be in the book with a couple of people that I really admired and still do and helped shape me very early on in my coaching career.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you know what? I had a great time hanging out with Stephen and his son, Sean, and getting to know those guys. And he was, definitely one of my favorite people. And Ken Blanchard, also a great, what do you call it, leader and an icon in the business world. And not just in the business world, but really even in the publishing world. I think he was the first softback book that sold for like $20 or $25. And it broke several records. One, I believe it became a New York Times bestselling book. And it was like, whatever it was, the 1 Minute Manager, for those who remember the 1 Minute Manager, which is still out in publication today. It's, it was like 100 pages or 150 pages. Selling for like $20, and that was kind of a big deal as well. And he just really made a big name for himself by delivering so much value and, very simply and very, small amount of pages.
Yeah, I mean, it's an iconic book. If you if you're a business owner or a manager or an executive of any sort, you that has to have been on your list, of the books that, if you go to Paris, you got to see the Eiffel Tower. You go into business, you got to read that book,
Absolutely, absolutely. Hey, and let's talk about this real quick, because one of the things that you mentioned is that taking a business from startup to what is it, $7 million? I'm not $7 million, but into seven figures in 3 years or less. I want to talk about this. My understanding is like 4 or 5% of businesses reach that $1 million mark. And I want to get your thoughts on this. Why is this $1 million mark so hard to reach?
Yeah, it's right. It's 4% of all businesses will ever reach $1 million in revenue, you know, and 96% never will. And, you know, it's... you know, it's not that it's everybody's goal. Not everybody's goal is to get big or get, you know, become a large business. But, you know, hitting that $1 million mark says a lot. It says that you've not only figured out who to sell to, how much to sell to them, how often, at what price, and at what frequency, no doubt about that, but you've also shown your ability to scale your business. And so, the reason why most don't make it is that, you know, it's well, first off, it's hard. I mean, there's, you know, only one in 15 people are a business owner in the first place. So you're already starting out in a limited pool. But what people miss and what business owners forget is that when it comes to scaling a business, they can't scale themselves, right? You can't scale your talent. You know, there's not 1,000 of you. Now, you could create the systems that allow other people to service the client, use their talents, and you know, and you can scale your business. You can scale the systems. You just can't scale the talent. You can replicate it. You could duplicate it to some degree, but you can't scale en masse. You have to create a platform that allows other people to perform. Probably one of the best recent examples of this, Bert, is McDonald's has just nailed it in this regard. They have a commercial right now where they show one of the employees walking in, kind of nervous. He's got an envelope in his hand, and you know he's kind of wants to show it to his boss, but then doesn't really want to show it to his boss. And boss grabs it out of his hand and says, "Come on, let's read it in front of everybody." And he reads it out loud, and it says, "Yes, you've been accepted to college." You know, and McDonald's says, "You know, McDonald's, we want to be America's best first job." You know, and if you think about it, I mean, they've nailed that positioning, but they've built a platform where just about anybody can work and perform their job, and the client has a very consistent and positive experience. You know, I mean, what does McDonald's have? 40,000 locations. You know, and quick quiz for you, Bert: how many chefs have you ever seen inside of the world's largest restaurant? Yeah, none. You know, you wouldn't find one because what they've done is they've created a menu. Their executive chef at Hamburger University has set the menu. And now everybody, and they've created this system where other people can replicate that. So so the part that most business owners miss is is the part about scale, and scale requires you to give up control. And allow other people to perform at a high level. And so, and not everybody's willing to do that. And so that's part of the reasons why they can't get over that hump. They have to be the star, or they don't trust anybody else, or they're not able to put the systems and processes in place that will allow somebody else to be, you know, to get the glory.
Right. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. Sometimes it's a control issue, and then other times it's a fear issue, right? When you're allowing other people to step in and, you know, that can be scary. And sometimes I know when I've talked to people, some of their biggest problems, and you nailed it, is that they can't scale the talent. They'll hire people and they get burnt out because they hire and fire, and they can't seem to fire the right people. And that can be very challenging. And so, there, you know, as you said, there's many factors, you know, but I like the analogy of the McDonald's and what McDonald's is famous for, again, for, you know, they are the guys to look at when you're looking at, a system, right? I mean, Ray Kroc didn't even start McDonald's. The McDonald's brothers started McDonald's, and they're the ones who opened Ray Kroc's eyes to this system that they had created, and Ray Kroc ran with it, and Ray Kroc was able to systemize it and franchise it and really leverage and exploit that system to the point, as you said, they're like, 40,000 strong now? The world's largest food delivery restaurant company in the world, it's McDonald's.
Yeah, and you can't find a chef anywhere. You know, which goes against which goes against thinking. If I were to tell you that, hey, listen, I'm going to build the world's biggest restaurant. It's going to have the most locations, and the primary worker is going to be somebody where this is probably their first job. They're more than likely a teenager, and they have no food service experience. And that's how I'm going to build the world's biggest restaurant. You would say, you're crazy. What are you thinking? And yet they've done that. It's exactly what they've done, you know?
Yeah, and what do you call it? Not to mention, Carl, that it's profitable. It's highly profitable, right? And so here you are, you're going to create this restaurant, as you said, with unskilled workers and multiple locations, and it's going to be profitable, and you're not going to have a chef. Yeah, that's incredible.
You know, just if you think about the implication of that. So what happens, and I get it for somebody who is an attorney or an accountant or, you know, or a consultant type or a sales rep, they might say, well, look, my, or a small retail shop, they might say, you know, my name is on this. I don't trust anyone else. I don't care how good they are. So I get that. And if that's the way that you want to go, then, you know, by all means, that's the way you're going to run your business. But the challenge you have when you are a small business owner is if you hold on and you have to be the star of the show, the good news is you will always have a job because you're probably really good at what you do. You'll always be in demand, and people are going to want you, you know, as the primary delivery system for the service or the product. Okay, cool. But the downside is you're always going to be stuck in that job, and you can never, ever leave it. You can never give it up because, you know, you're always going to be in demand, and you know, everybody has their own reason why they got into business, you know, and if that's what you want to do in your business, then that's cool. And if you love what you do, you know, it's a great place to be because you're getting to do what you love. So, you know, no problems there, but you can't ever escape. And being a business owner just takes too much energy to have to be the primary person doing everything all the time. It's just, it's exhausting. And when you try to be everything, you become the exhausted mediocre, not the cutting edge and refreshed, you know, not the cutting edge and refreshed, you know, impeccable example in your industry. You know, it'll wear you out tired, and that's where a lot of people get burnt out, and they can't sustain the results that they've gotten because it just takes too much, energy to sustain it.
Well, and on top of that, correct me if I'm wrong here. You know, I don't think I've ever met an entrepreneur who says, "Carl, I'd like to get a job. I'd like to create a company and be tied to this company 24/7 and never be able to leave it." It's the reverse, right? You believe, the entrepreneur believes that, hey, I'm going to start this company and I'm going to grow it to a point where either I exit that company or it runs by itself or it doesn't need me 24/7 or some variation of time freedom, right? That's
right.
The reason to get business for yourself, because let me tell you, if all you want is a high-paying job, there are other ways to get a high-paying job that are easier than having everything on your shoulders.
Yeah. Yeah, starting a business to have more time, you know, and becoming self-employed to have more time is like having a baby so you can get more sleep. You know what I mean? It's just you know, it just doesn't work that way. I don't care what you're thinking, you know? I mean,
yeah.
And so
yeah.
But people say they look at their boss and they say, "Oh my God, if I'm as dumb as that person, I can be a millionaire too. I'm in. I want to try this out." You know, and so they give it a whirl. God bless them, and they go for it. But the reality is that it's a lot harder than it looks, you know, and they've got to, you know, you get a very healthy respect for the boss, for the risk they take and the amount that they go through every day to make sure the people around them have a job, you know. And so it's a whole new paradigm there for sure.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? And the reason that it's so hard, or let me rephrase it, it is hard. And it's obviously hard because 80% of all businesses fail within like what, 2 years?
Yep.
And then like 95% fail within 5 years. It's hard.
Yeah, 95% of independently owned and operated businesses fail within the first 5 years, but 90% of franchise businesses last 10 years.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough. So if you look, and the main difference between a franchise business and an independently owned and operated business is simply the systems, you know?
Yeah.
They have systems in place, and the independently owned and operated company, you know, says, "Oh, I don't need all those rules. That's why I got in a business. So I don't follow the rules," you know? And so they don't put the systems in place and ultimately fail as a result.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Well,
unfortunately.
And I think what it is they just simply don't understand the power of the systems. I tell people this, the reason that the pyramids have withstood the test of time is because they had a system. They had a system of carving these colossal blocks of granite or whatever out of wherever they carved them out of, hauled them across the terrain or down the river or however they delivered those things, and got them into perfect alignment. And these things, yes, it took years. Yes, it was labor intensive, but they have withstood this test of time, just like McDonald's has withstood the test of time because of their system. And, you know, for me, the big aha moment for me, like it was for so many people, was the E-Myth by
Michael Gerber.
Michael Gerber, yeah. And so how could I forget Michael? And so, yeah, so Michael Gerber. But that to me was like, duh, how did I not see that? And it was to me, that's one of those books that you must have and review constantly. I think that people overlook the importance of systems. And I think a lot of it is they just don't think about it like that. As you were saying earlier, they are good at what they do. And, you know, if you and I were – you know, well, maybe not you and I, because we would probably say, "Okay, Bert, we're going to start a business today. Let's start putting the systems together," but only because we have that experience. But I think the average person starting a business doesn't think about systems first. They think about cash flow first. They think about, you know, their logo. They think about other things other than having a system.
Yeah. Yeah, and anything other, and you know, systems sounds like way too much like a job. It sounds way too much like school. All the things that they said that they didn't, you know, that they'll never do if, you know, the day they're in charge. And one of the traps that, you know, an entrepreneur falls into is they actually start to rebel against the very systems that will help them. Meaning, you know, they're in their own business now, right? They set up some systems that they know will be good for the business. But the first person to rebel against the systems is the owner themselves, you know, and they sabotage their own success by, you know, being, you know, sticking it to the man. But the only problem is you're the man. You're sticking it to yourself, you know, so
yeah.
It just doesn't always make sense, you know.
You know, one of the best conversations I ever had was with George Lucas, the guy who probably people best know for Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And he said it snuck up on him that what he attempted to do was to get away from these big corporations and become this independent guy. But because of the success of Indiana Jones and Star Wars and some other movies and some other things, other properties, assets that they created, he became this giant corporation. And he says it just, you know, of course he does give credit, you know, to everybody that helped him do all that stuff. But he says it was not his intention to become this big thing. He always intended to keep it small. And of course, that's the exception, not the rule, because I think most people intend to make it big and unfortunately keep it small. Like you said, you know, at first you say, "Hey, I'm going to get away from the man. I don't want to be under all these rules." Until eventually, you are the man making the rules.
Right, and then you realize, you know, there's this great commercial on TV right now for Geico where they say, you know, we can't make you not become your parents, but we can save you money on insurance. And it's this support group where these, you know, people in their probably 40s, I would say, are sitting around quoting their parents and, you know, trying to figure out how to stop doing that. But, you know, you realize you get a little, you get, you know, some seasoning behind you and you get some, you know, you get burnt a few times. And before you know it, you realize, you know, systems aren't so bad. As a matter of fact,
right.
You realize the structure and you realize how much you actually flourish under the system and the structure. I don't know anyone who plays fantasy football who complains about the rules. They go in the other direction. They're like, "Hey, what are the rules? How many points do I get for a touchdown? How many points do I get for this? When can I trade? When can I not?" And it's funny because they want the rules so bad, because once they understand the rules, they know they can win the game. And business is the same thing. You know, say, okay, well, what corporate structure allows me to take the maximum tax deduction? Cool. So if I buy this way, that way, and then I deduct it that way, or do I use a subcontractor versus a direct employee? You know, what are the advantages and disadvantages? And should I become a nonprofit and give away a certain amount of profits as opposed to keep them or whatever? You know, it's the same. Once you realize that business is one of the best games of chess ever invented, it's fantasy football, but for products and services as opposed to a game, you know, business can be one of the most fun things that you get involved in. But you got it. Yeah. I mean, you got to have a scoreboard. You got to know the rules.
Yes.
So you know who's winning, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, you know, well, let's talk about this, because again, as I mentioned in the intro, you built not one, not two, but three multimillion dollar businesses by the age of 40. So what are some of the best lessons that you learned in business in the early days of your career? I don't know if anything sticks to mind, maybe one or two nuggets that you have always kept with you.
Well, it was actually when I started out in business, I was I was going to school at the University of Delaware for accounting and finance. I broke my leg pretty badly. I had to leave school. So long story short, I started a landscaping company. It's what I had done in high school. I kind of knew it, kind of knew the ropes. So started a landscaping company. And one of the best lessons I learned in business, I learned in my first week of business. And I'm so grateful for it, because what it has meant to me over time. And I went on my first three appointments, and I won all three appointments. I got the business each time, me too. I was the most surprised guy in the room, and I'm thinking, my God, forget accounting and finance, man. I was just born for landscaping. I must be blessed by the landscaping gods. And if there was a 23andMe back then or Ancestry.com, it would have, you know, landscaping would have come in my DNA. You know, maybe that's what I was thinking. And so I was encouraged to go back to the people who said yes to me and who hired me, to ask them why they chose my services over somebody else. And the number one piece of feedback I got the first year in business was that I was the guy who showed up, who gave them the promise that I would call them back, I would give them a proposal by a certain time and do it. And in more cases than not, I was the only guy that showed up in the time frame that I promised. And I quite honestly couldn't believe my ears. I was like, are you guys kidding? Like, are you joking with me? Because I was an 18-year-old kid. And so I realized that whole year that I learned what the big complaints were of my clients and what their pain points were. And I said, wait a minute, there's something going on here. So what I did was I made a list of the top five complaints of what people were telling me they hated working with contractors. And so the next year I took an ad out in the Yellow Pages and I just made a couple of promises. But the main promise I made was all phone calls returned. That's it.
Wow.
And so I was overrun with leads. So I'm going out on all these leads and I start to realize, wait a minute, they're not even questioning my pricing. So I started to raise my pricing. I raised it again until somebody pulled me aside. And this was the oddest day ever in business I've ever had. And they pulled me aside and they said, Carl, your pricing is obnoxious. You are off the reservation high and you are almost double the last person we said we would never hire because they were too high. And that's why we put it back out to bid. And that's how we met you. And then they lectured me about my pricing. And at the end of the lecture, they hired me. And I remember getting the deposit check. Yeah, I walk out of there and I'm like, what the WTF? What's going on? What just happened? And I realized, I said, holy cow. I said, I think I've tapped into something. And what I realized that is if I, and this goes for anybody, if I understand what is the most important thing to you or among the most important things to you, and I give it to you, you will be willing to pay a lot more. You will be willing to pay a lot more for my product and service than if I was just an average Joe. And so what I came up with was something called the obnoxious offer. And the obnoxious offer is think of it as a premium service. You know, it's, you know, white glove, titanium level, whatever you want to call it. But it's the top level service offering to my clients at a top level price. And so What I did was I just offered in all of my service offerings, I included what I call the obnoxious offer. It had the biggest guarantee. It had, you know, it had the biggest promises. So I was a contractor. So a knock on contractors is they give you one price and they charge you another. So I said, fixed pricing. Here's my price. It will never go up. As long as the scope of work stays the same, my price stays the same. You said you need it done by a certain day, I will be done on that day. If it rains every day, I was a landscaper, so outside work. If it rains every day from now till then, I will work in the rain to get it done for you by that time. And they were like, wow, this is great. Like every complaint, every objection they had, I had an answer. It'll be done on time. It'll be done on budget. I won't go over, and I guarantee all the work. And they're like, huh, great. And then I would give them the price, and they would go, whoa. I said, well, you want it all guaranteed. You want me to work through the night and on Sundays and through the rain? You want me to take all of that risk with you? There's the price. And so we would offer the obnoxious price right next to the regular medium price. And we outsold – more people bought the obnoxious offer than the other offers. And we found out that if you find your ideal client who values what you do, they actually value your product or service, and they value the effort and the risk and the time that you spend to serve them, they will be willing to pay a premium price. And so one of the early lessons I learned was don't be afraid to maximize your pricing, because your passionate clients not only will pay it, they will pay it and brag about it. Think about it. Bert, how many people do you know that wear a Rolex and complain about the price?
Zero.
Zero. They brag about it. They'll say, no.
Yeah.
Look, check this thing out. Look at it. I got the Mariner one. Yeah, like $7,500. I mean, they're happy to tell you that they've saved up for years, or, hey, this is the gift I gave myself after 20 years or whatever. It is, it's a status symbol or a symbol of achievement for them, and they want to tell you about it. I know a few people who own a Tesla car, not one of them, well, they'll all tell you what they paid. Every single one of them has told me what they paid for it, and not one of them complains about it. They're like, oh, yeah, this is $186,000. Oh, it took me 3 years to get the financing for this one, but I've been dreaming about this car since it came out, and I wanted it. And so they not only will pay it, they'll go around and tell others, you ought to drive this thing. It's unbelievable. Save your money. Get this car. It's incredible. Buy that watch. It's incredible. Get those box seats. It's incredible. And so if you build what I would call the obnoxious offer, where you take your pricing and you double your pricing, then you double it again, and then you build all the bonuses and guarantees and incentives that make it seem like a good value, you will have a segment of your clientele that will pay it.
Right. And what's so nice about this is that this is the kind of pricing that if, let's say, only 20 or 30% of your clientele takes it, it doubles your business.
Oh, there's no question about it. And it's all what you're doing is you're providing intangibles. So these intangibles, like a guarantee, these intangibles have risk associated with them. But if you price yourself right and you figure, okay, I'm going to pay a refund 1 out of 20 times, but the 19 times I get the premium, it pays for the one refund I have to give, then you should be covered. And when you're offering premium services, it's almost always intangibles. The guarantee, the responsiveness, the professionalism, you know, the fact that you give back to a charity, you know, like Tom's Shoes. You buy a pair of shoes from us, we're going to go donate a pair of shoes to an underprivileged child somewhere in the world. Or Bombas Socks, who does the same thing with socks. Buy socks from us, we give another pair away. In business, I learned this very early on, is people cared as much about my how and my why as much as they cared about my what. So my what was landscaping, but my how was the way we built with quality, and my why was the guaranteed max price, the whole bit. So they paid as much, if not more, for the how and the why as they did for the what. That was my big takeaway very early on in my career. I was very blessed, you know, and grateful that I learned it, and I've used it in every business I've ever owned and every business I've ever advised ever since.
Yeah, that's amazing takeaway too. And I hope that everybody listening gets that. I mean, listen to what he's saying. Your ideal clients will pay 3 or 4 or 5 times the ordinary price for the right amount of bells and whistles. And you know what? I'm going to give you my own example. I am 55. When I hit, 40 or 45, like a lot of guys, we respond by, you know, going down this, we get excited about our health or whatever. And I've always been into health and fitness, so I wanted to take it to the next level. And there is this guy that I wanted to work with, and he was in Las Vegas. And at that time, I lived in Houston, Texas. And I would pay him a few thousand dollars a year, plus I would fly 4 times a year to work with him. Besides, you know, so I incurred all these expenses, plus it was inconvenient as all get out, but the benefits outweighed everything. And so if the benefits are there, people will move heaven and earth to get to your, as you call it, your obnoxious price, to be involved with you because they believe in the benefits so much.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And they value the benefit. I mean, think about this. You go to a Disney park and you can buy the express ticket so you don't stand in line. You know, people go to the amusement park. They want the experience. They want it so much that they would be happy to pay extra for an intangible. They're not paying for the ride. They get the ride either way. What they're paying for is I don't have to wait in line to get to the ride. You know what I mean? And so they'll pay the extra fee just for that.
Yeah.
So it's that was a very early lesson. I applied it. It was something that was that I found really worked well for me, and I found that it's not only worked. I mean, we've done business in 35 countries, Bert. So I've used this everywhere, and I've used it in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and now the 2010s. I mean, I've been in business since that point, and I have found it works everywhere, every kind of business, because the buyers are the same. They want service. They want their problem solved. No matter what you have to sell, no matter what your product or service is, your customers have a problem. They want you to solve it, and if you're able to solve it the first time and give them a good experience along the way, they are going to want to pay you for it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know what? And let's talk about this, because I think this is something that messes people up tremendously. And that is charging what they think, you know, they deserve. Just pricing in general, Carl, seems to mess people up. I mean, I think, you know, we've all come across people that are charging way too little, and then when you talk to them about increasing their prices, they don't want to offend anybody, but yet they can't make their, you know, they can't pay their bills. They have a bunch of clients, but they still aren't profitable because they're not willing to charge a good price. Any tips on how people can get over that whole pricing issue?
Sure. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, as a matter of fact, this is something that's near and dear to my heart, because I hear this a lot, and we deal with this with a lot of our clients. And one of the things that we deal with a lot is people will say, you know, I don't want to raise my prices because I'm trying to help out the customers, keep things cheap. And what you don't realize when you keep your pricing static is you don't change your pricing, at some point, your customer is going to think, wait a minute, how are you able to keep your pricing the same when virtually everything keeps going up in price? You know, yeah. I used to have a TV. I paid nothing for television. Now I pay $100 a month to watch TV. My very first cell phone was $100, and now I just paid $1,000 for my Samsung or my iPhone. Everything goes up in price, and we expect everything to go up in price. How come you have it? And they start to realize, well, wait a minute, if you're able to charge me the same price over years, you're not losing money every year, so you must have been overcharging me in the past. And now your clientele is going to feel betrayed. So this is the part most people don't get. They think, oh, no, I'm helping the client out. No, you're not. You are planting the seed in their mind that you have been screwing them for years, right? So think about this for a second. I remember buying a suit from Joseph A. Bank 10 years ago, the top-of-the-line signature suit, and I think it was like $900. A year ago, I go in and I go to buy a suit, and I said, oh, I want another signature suit. And they said, oh, good news. If you buy one signature suit, we will give you three for free. I said, you're going to give me three signature suits for nothing? And they said, well, yeah, it's a special we're doing. I said, wait a minute, I spent the same price on this years ago. So my head did not go to, wow, what a great deal. Aren't you guys a bunch of great guys? I mean, I bought the suits and I was very happy to only pay $1,000 for four suits, not for one suit. But when I walked out of there saying, wait a minute, so were you overcharging me 10 years ago? Have you been overcharging me for 10 years and you now, it just now caught up with you? Is that what's going on here? So what it did was it put doubt in my mind that I was being treated fairly all those years. And so you might say, well, that's great news. They have, efficiencies of scale and this and that. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you're telling me 10 years later, when everything else in this world costs more to do, you not only could give me the same suit for less money, you can throw in three more? So essentially my $1,000 suit 10 years ago is $250 today? How is that possible? Now, maybe it was possible, and maybe they found some secret sauce that the rest of the world doesn't know about, but that's not where my head went. My head went to, as a loyal customer, my head went to, well, wait a minute, have you been being honest with me all these years? Have you been being fair with me, or have you been overcharging me? So when you keep your pricing static, you run the risk of your clients thinking of you as somebody who might be taking advantage of you. So I would be very, very careful there.
Yeah. And you know, here's, again, I'm going to give everybody my personal experience with trying to do things cheap for the sake of the client. So this is the lesson. I learned two lessons. A, I had this. So here's a story. I should start off this way. I had this lady who needed help with marketing. And, you know, I'm trying to be the nice guy. I'm trying to help her out. And I'm doing everything inexpensively and basically saying, hey, look, do these three steps. And when they're done, come back and let me know and blah, blah, blah. And so bottom line is, after working with me for a year, she had done very little, and she had paid me only a couple $1,000s because, again, I'm charging her a low amount of money, and so therefore I'm not involved a whole lot. I'm just, you know, whatever, giving her whatever I think a couple of grand is worth. At the end of that year, she was unhappy. She ended up hiring somebody else that did everything for her. Charge her like $5,000 or $6,000 or $10,000. She's ecstatic with that person and unhappy with me. And so lesson learned is, you know, when you try to have that attitude of doing it cheap because you think you're helping the client out, in a lot of cases, you're delivering a disservice. Because in my case, you know, I didn't want to fully invest because the client wasn't fully invested. So neither the client or I were happy about the couple $1,000s the client paid me. That's number one. Number two, if your client can't afford to pay your fair price or your obnoxious price, then they should go someplace else. Because we all know that one unhappy client can really cost you 10 new clients. That's
right.
My takeaway on the whole cheap price thing. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's at a base minimum, before the conversation even starts, you have to be solving their problem. You have to be helping them in a way. You have to help them in a way that is solving their issues, and they feel good about it. That's number one.
Yes.
And then, you know, then the second part is, okay, let's talk about. You know, what the price is, and is that price range fit me, and am I that kind of buyer? You know, you can have that conversation. That's cool. But the, you know, at a minimum, they have to be happy with the outcome, or, you know, you're that's where you're going to run into a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And here's the other thing. So, again, I learned that lesson. And so if you fast forward a few years later, I have a gentleman who wants my services, and he absolutely cannot afford it. He is telling me, you know, Carl, I'm broke. My business is not doing well. My wife is mad at me all the time. I'm thinking about getting a job because I've maxed out my credit cards. And, of course, instead of trying to do something cheaply this time, I say, hey, you know, Bob, that's great. I understand. You know what? It's not a good fit for you now. Come back when it is a good fit because I'm here to help you. And, you know, I don't want to put you in a situation that's going to hurt you. But unfortunately, I can't deliver this level of service at a lesser price. So we part friends. Carl, 3 or 4 days go by, maybe a week goes by. He calls me up. He says, Bert, I got the money. I'm ready to roll.
Huh. Go figure.
And go figure. And so another lesson that I learned is, you know, a lot of times, you know, we think that we're this great salesperson or whatever, and a lot of times the clients have already convinced themselves, and you don't have to do anything else. But bottom line is, this whole price thing is so important that I think a lot of people end up hurting themselves because they don't understand it, they don't value, they don't know how to figure out their value, and it is, you know, I mean, it's such an important thing, because at the right price, you can scale your business. At the wrong price, you're filing bankruptcy.
Right. And if you are truly bringing value, the marketplace will respond.
Yes.
So you've got to get the word out there. You can't climb down a well and start whispering about your services. You got to climb a tree and scream it out. But if there's this fear that, you know, if it costs too much, and there are plenty of price shoppers out there, so you can always make the case, well, there's this one lady or this one guy who complained about my pricing, and that's why I dropped it. There's always going to be a price shopper out there. But if you really understand what makes your ideal client avatar tick, what really goes on in their mind and what's really important to them, they are willing to pay the premium. And we've all done it. I mean, think about anything that you've paid a premium for in your life. You not only did it, you're happy to do it.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely. You know what? And you gave a great example of the Disney. There's a hamburger place called Whataburger. And I grew up with Whataburger there in Texas. And it just so happens it's in Arizona as well. And that was kind of a nice bonus because I am a big fan of hamburgers. So Whataburger does not have a discounted 99-cent menu like all the other burger joints have. If you want a burger at their place, it's like $4. If you don't want a burger at their place, you just go someplace else. But, you know, I'm willing to go out of my way because they happen not to be close by. They're not on every corner like a McDonald's. So I'm willing to go out of my way, drive out of my way to go get the burger because, again, the benefits, I like it that much more. I'm willing to pay out the nose for it and again, be inconvenienced by it. All right, so anyway, just to move on, guys, price is a really big, important thing. You got to figure it out. Let's talk about marketing. This is another area where people really drop the ball. One of my favorite lies, and I've heard this from so many people, is, oh, you know what? I don't spend any money on marketing. It's all word of mouth. I don't know anybody that's that good. I've never met a person, a product, or a thing that can survive purely on word of mouth. And when somebody says, no, you know what, I don't do any marketing at all, everything's word of mouth, and we're this colossal success, I typically leave them alone because I just don't believe them. What's your take on marketing?
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. And here's a kind of a litmus test for your business. And think of it this way. If you are a business that is friends selling to friends, then you are probably not going to reach that $1 million mark. You're probably not a sustainable company, and you're going to have a challenge growing and sustaining that growth. And friends selling to friends is just what you said. It's word of mouth referral. You don't do a lot of marketing, and you do a job for somebody. They become your friend. You do a nice job. They refer you to one of their friends. So you are a friend, marketing and selling to friends. What you need to become at some point in your business is strangers selling to strangers. And what that means is you hired somebody to do sales that you've never met before. You bring them in, you hire them, now they work for you. And you hired a stranger whose job is to go out and find other strangers so you can sell your products and services to. And so you need to go from friends marketing and selling to friends to strangers marketing and selling to strangers. And that's when your business can start to scale, and that's when your business can start to grow in a way that it could never grow on its own. And that requires you to put a system in place.
Yes, I love that. I love that. Absolutely. I think life doesn't get much easier than friends selling to friends, because sometimes they'll buy from you just because they're your friend. Sometimes they'll buy from you, you know, because they actually need the product. You know, there's a lot of different reasons why they'll buy from you. But I love the idea of what you said, strangers selling to strangers. And that requires, back to what we started talking about before, a system. You know, your business is really going to be predicated on your systems. And, you know, bottom line is, if there is a company out there that you admire, it probably has multiple systems in place. And bottom line is, you know, you can't scale without a system. Let's talk about this real quick. Again, you have done some amazing things. I mentioned this before, not one, not two, but three multi-million dollar businesses. When it comes down to it, as an entrepreneur, here you are, you've been a serial entrepreneur for 30 years. What is your opinion? What does it take to get on top and stay on top?
Well, thank you. It's, you know, I've been blessed in my career to be able to, you know, have some success and also be able to, you know, be able to do the work that I love. And when early in my career, Bert, I learned that one of the most exhausting things that you can do in your life is go to work every day and spend 8 hours or more a day doing what you don't love to do. And I found that that is tremendously exhausting. You can't be as good at it than if you loved everything that you did. It just doesn't work that way. And so one of the things that I learned was that I am more than happy to do the extra work, to hustle, to outwork the next person when I love what I do. And here's how it manifests. When it comes to selling my products and services, when it comes to servicing the client, when I love what I'm doing, I find I am more committed to the client saying yes than the client is committed to saying no to me. You know, so in other words, if I am passionate about something that I think they should do or a path they should take, I find that I can talk them into it, not because I'm some great salesperson, because I'm not. What I believe I bring to the table is I'm so confident and so passionate in what I'm doing and the benefit to the client that they will run out of no's before I run out of reasons to say yes. And to be honest, if you are not totally passionate about what you do, you won't have as many yeses. You won't be as committed to the client. You won't be as committed to making sure the client gets their result as, say, I would be. So I might you know, put in a proposal for work against an equally qualified coach or consultant, but I will more than likely win that account or win that work. Not because I'm more qualified, but I believed in it more and I sold it more passionately and I made a better case because I simply would not accept a no as an answer. And I had so many reasons why you ought to do this and so many reasons why it'd be crazy if you didn't do this that they would say, well, all right, well, you know, and in sales and when you're growing your business, the phrase, if you can't beat them, join them, is really true.
Right.
Because when people are out of no's, there's only one answer left, and it's yes. And if you don't believe in what you do enough, because if you think about it, think of any entrepreneur that you know, and when they will tell you a story similar to this. They will say something like, when I told my family I was going to start this business, most of them told me, are you crazy? What's your backup plan? Get your degree. So if the whole thing with software doesn't work out, you can fall back on being a welder or whatever, you know.
Right.
And you get a lot of negative feedback. You have to overcome the negative feedback, the rejections, the objections in order to get to a yes. And you can only do that if you are passionate about what you do, you totally believe in it, and you're confident about it. And so that's been the success secret for me, because I flat out hustled most people to the finish line, and that's how I was able to get to the $1 million or above mark and stay there.
Yeah, you know, one of the first guys that I had the pleasure of becoming friends with and who mentored me was a gentleman named Wayne Huizenga, which a lot of people do not – you might know his name, but a lot of people don't know his name. So Wayne Huizenga, real quick, was the guy behind Waste Management, was the guy behind Blockbuster, was the guy behind AutoNation. And Wayne basically said the same thing. Not only was he passionate about waste hauling, he said one of the reasons I loved it is because so many people appreciated it, right? And it wasn't a glamorous business, but it was very profitable. And he says that one of the reasons that he was able to achieve success and reach that $1 million plus mark is because he was so passionate about it that he was willing to invest his profits, take out loans, and really put everything on the line when a lot of other waste haulers weren't. And from there, he got fairly large. He was able to grow his sales, and then he gobbled up smaller waste haulers, and he became Waste Management. It was an overnight success. It only took 20 years, but he was the just like you. What he talked about was the passion and the love that you must have to grow your business from zero to $1 million mark plus. And I just find that interesting that you said the same thing.
Yeah, very. You will receive so much resistance from the marketplace. You have to be more. You can't do it on just willpower alone. You won't make it. And it's too hard. It takes too much energy and focus, and it just takes too much time. And it will eat you up if you aren't. Totally passionate and fully committed to what you're doing, and you better love it, because you're going to take a lot of resistance along the way, and so you've got to be just that committed to the process.
Yeah, you know, you look at Elon Musk is somebody else who I admire quite a bit. You know, he's put everything on the line. He's very passionate, very focused, unfortunately, he got divorced, and I think he's gotten divorced and married, as he finished one project and married as he started Tesla or whatever, something like that. But yeah, you put everything on the line, sometimes it can have some bad effects, but I think filing bankruptcy or failing over and over again has similar effects. I mean, we've had more people divorce over a failing business than we've had people divorce over a successful business. And I used to tell my wife, honey, if, because again, I was a workaholic too. And so I would always explain to my wife, if we were to get divorced, don't you want to divorce me when I have millions of dollars versus when I have nothing? And of course, she would agree with that. And so that would always, kind of pacify her. And luckily, we have not been divorced, and we've been able to see it to the other side. So thank you for hanging in there, my sweet wife. Carl, we're out of time. It's been such a blast getting to know you and learning about your journey as a serial entrepreneur, and getting a peek on how to grow your business, scale it, how to stay on top. Some of the great ideas here. Excuse me. You know, we talked about why you need systems. We talked about why so many companies, 4% of the companies, reach $1 million. Great story about your landscaping business. The things that you learned from there about, the top complaints and the obnoxious offers, that right there was worth everything. That to me is a brilliant, brilliant insight. And then, of course, we discovered what it takes to stay on top. And so, Carl Gould, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. And is there a website if somebody wants to follow you or connect with you? What's the website that they can find out more about you?
Sure. You could go to carlgould.com, CARLGOULD. Just go to carlgould.com. And, Bert, we offer a free business analysis, our way of giving back to the entrepreneurial community, a free business analysis and coaching session to any of your listeners that want to take us up on it. They can go to carlgould.com or text the word hypergrowth to our short code 313131.
I love it. Hypergrowth 313131. Text hypergrowth 313131. Carl Gould, thank you so much for stopping by.
Hey, thanks, Bert. Appreciate it.
Good stuff there from serial entrepreneur Carl Gould. I love that landscaping story. I mean, that to me, I love that story for several reasons. A, here's a college kid who broke his leg so badly he had to leave college. What do you do? Well, I started a landscaping business. You know, I was waiting for him to tell me that he rested for 3 or 4 months. No, I started a landscaping business, and I'm sure there was some rest in there, but I just love the way it segued into his landscaping business. And I love what he taught, what he learned and what he taught us from his landscaping business. That to me was priceless information. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.